From KMUW Studios and part of the NPR Podcast Network, this is Books and Whatnot. I'm Suzanne Perez, KMUW's resident book reviewer.
And I'm Beth Goulet, host of KMUW's Marginalia podcast. This episode was recorded on September 27th, 2024. Any references to new or forthcoming and the like are relative.
Well, hello, Beth.
Hello, Suzanne.
How are you today?
I cannot believe I live in a world where it's actually October.
Oh, just like Anne of Green Gables.
Well, no, like it's already October. What the hell happened?
Yeah, that too. You know, it's just a downhill slide to the holidays.
But it was just January.
I know. It's 2024, soon to be 2025.
Okay.
So much happening. But it is such a great season for books. It's kind of spooky season, which I'll talk about later. And coming up later in this episode, as we, I just love this. It's not even new anymore. This is a, we've done it several times.
This is, I think, our fifth time.
Yeah. So we will be talking to an independent bookseller from Richmond, Virginia. Her name is Kelly Justice, and she runs a store out there called Fountain Bookstore. So we'll be talking with her later this episode about some October releases and then some other sort of releases over the past few months that she's really excited about.
Yeah, I'm really excited to hear from Kelly. But I'm also excited to hear from you. What do you have? Let's just jump right into the books, I think.
Yeah, okay, yeah, let's do it. You know, I'm going to bookend the books I'm talking about with two spooky things. It is that time of year when I like to read horror. I don't read much horror. I certainly read more now than I used to. But the first book I want to talk about, it's called We Used to Live Here by Marcus Cleaver. So this book has kind of an interesting backstory to it. It actually began life as a serialized short story on Reddit.
Oh, okay.
So there was a subreddit called the No Sleep subreddit, and it was all, you know, just sort of scary stories and people who are interested in horror, reading and writing horror type books. And Marcus Cleaver started this book over there, and it was so popular that it was picked up, interestingly, first as a movie. So someone bought the movie rights to his story, and then he turned it into this novel.
That's an interesting trajectory.
It is an interesting journey for a novel, isn't it? Because the movie's not out yet. It's supposed to star Blake Lively, actually.
Oh, wow.
But anyway, so it's all over the socials. The kids are talking about it, all the book talkers and bookstagrammers. So I had to know what it was all about. It's got one of the best premises of any horror novel you can think of. It's perfect for this time of year. So this couple of women buys an old house. It's in a remote area in Oregon. And as they're fixing up the house, they hear a knock at the door. And they one of them answers the door, and the people there, there's a family standing there on the doorstep. It's a man with his wife and two children. And he says, hey, I used to live in this house a few years back, lived here for a while. Would it be okay if we came in and had a look around? I could show the kids around. You could totally see that happening, couldn't
yeah,
you?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. I'd let anybody in who said that to me.
Well, don't. Because, and I'm going to tell you why. No, it was not wise. And you, I mean, well, obviously, when you're in a haunted house novel, you should not do that.
Mm-hmm.
But I could totally see someone walking up. You know, I think about houses I used to live in, you know, my hometown. I could totally see myself driving by my old house. So this main character, Eve, lets this family in, and, you know, things go awry, Beth. Her partner, Charlie, unexpectedly disappears. Things start moving around. It is so well written, though. The tension that he manages to create, his writing is fantastic. The narrative of the story is interspersed with all of these sort of documents. It almost has like an epistolary feel to it. Like between each chapter, he puts these maps and other documents, and it's even like Reddit style evidence of what's going on, something nefarious happening in this house. And it looks like, you know, in future years, people will look back at what happened and look at this evidence. So it's kind of hard to explain, but definitely hard to look away from this novel. It kept me interested. It creeped me out just enough, and I would suggest not reading this alone at night in a house that will make any kind of sounds. Like if you have a cat, for instance, it will make you jump. So that again is We Used to Live Here by Marcus Cleaver.
Does Cleaver have any other books? Is this the first one?
I think this is. This is his debut novel. Yes.
Interesting.
You know, I described it, the review is on KMUW.org, and I described it as kind of a mashup of Shirley Jackson and Jordan Peele.
Oh, okay.
It's got Get Out vibes, and then also We Have Always Lived in the Castle, which is also, by the way, another great book to read this time of year.
Yes.
Oh, my gosh. Anything Shirley Jackson.
Marriquette. Is that what she's...
Yes, Marriquette. Ooh, gives me the creepies. So that's some good October reading for you.
See, that one doesn't feel scary to me.
Oh, gosh, really? It's super suspenseful and creepy, though. I mean, it's not like jump scare necessarily, but you know something happened there that you're not quite aware of.
Yeah.
And it's unfolding and... Yeah, those characters and the house itself. Wow, I love that novel.
I do not read contemporary horror. I just, if I can avoid it, I do at all costs.
What about, you like Grady Hendrix, don't you?
Yeah, but that's almost...
It's almost humor.
Yes.
But it's scary. His last one, which I loved.
The Puppet?
Yes. Oh, my gosh. How to Sell a Haunted House. Oh, goodness, he has another book coming out, but not till January. And I don't know why his publisher doesn't put his books out in September, but
Oh, yeah. Interesting.
There must be some plan there. I don't know what it is, but, you know, it's going to be hard to not read that book as soon as it comes out in January. I don't know what the next one is, but I'm looking forward to it anyway.
Okay, so my first book is called Blue Sisters by Coco Mellors. And Coco Mellors is British, and she, when I asked her how to say her name, she's like, well, everybody in the United States says Mellors, which is what I would have thought.
Right.
It's just Mellors. And
kind of like Lydia Millet.
Yes.
It's not Malay.
It's just like the grain.
That's right. Author of Dinosaurs.
Okay, so Blue Sisters, as the title implies, this book is about four sisters with the last name Blue. There's Avery, Bonnie, Nikki, and Lucky. And they grew up in an apartment in New York City, but as adults, they, you know, kind of are dispersed all around the globe, and they couldn't be more different. Avery is a successful attorney living with her wife in London. Bonnie is a successful boxer who has just moved to LA to be a bouncer after a rough loss in the ring. We meet Lucky in Paris, where she's working as a model, and she's been working as a model since she turned 15. Although the sisters are estranged, they return to New York to pack up their childhood apartment a year after the unexpected death of their sister, Nikki, who needed pain pills for her endometriosis, and she took one that was laced with fentanyl.
Oh.
Right? Mm. So this story is about grief and the complexities of family, which, you know, those themes can be universal. But with this book, Mellors taps into her own history to explore the addictions of each sister. This book was really well done. Mellors, she also has a book out titled Cleopatra and Frankenstein, which I haven't read, and I don't even know what it's about. But Blue Sisters made me want to explore her backlist and also made me want to look for whatever she writes in the future.
Wow.
So, yeah, this was it was really well done. It was a really good book. And that's Blue Sisters by Coco Mellors.
That is definitely on my list. It's got a cool cover, too.
It does, yes.
I love that cover, the sort of paintings. It kind of reminds me of Hello, Beautiful, in a way.
Oh.
The cover does, anyway. I don't know if the story does.
I've not read Hello, Beautiful.
Oh, I thought you had.
I started it.
Anne Napolitano. That was a spring book, I believe.
Yeah, I didn't. It wasn't an assignment.
Yeah, I hear you.
So I did not read it.
Oh, yeah. Unfortunately. Yeah. Sometimes we have to, we don't get to read everything we want
That's right.
Like ever.
What's on your list?
Okay, my next one is There Are Rivers in the Sky. I'm not going to say it to
You've
you,
already
Beth.
Said it to me several times at work.
There Are Rivers in the Sky by Elif Shafak. And, you know, this might be one of my favorite books of the year. This is four episodes running now, possibly five, possibly ten,
probably,
that I have said that. This book is beautiful. So it's an epic, sweeping story told from multiple points of view, three different timelines going all the way back to ancient Mesopotamia with the Epic of Gilgamesh. And, the bookseller who hand sold me this book said that, and I was like, do I care about the Epic of Gilgamesh.
It's one of the first books in print ever.
It's very cool, and not even so much as, you know, what the poem says, but the journey that there was in its discovery and then translation. And that's what this book kind of looks at. One of the characters in this novel is the man who is born in squalor on the banks of the River Thames and becomes the one who is brilliant enough to see the patterns in those slate tablets and translate the epic poem. So there's all of these different sort of topics and things going on, all these different characters and different times. It comes all the way up to modern, well, almost modern day. It's like 2018, I believe. But what's also super cool is that Shafak in this story ties it all together with a single drop of water. So she shows through the falling of rain, and then it soaks into the earth, and then it evaporates, and it becomes snow somewhere else. And through the course of this novel, there are times when she describes that the same raindrop that might fall on this baby's face as he's born is in the spray of the ocean that hits his face as he's an adult landing on this shoreline in his adventure. So it was just beautiful. It really made me remember a book I loved called A Place for Us, which came out several years ago, but was it's still a book I think about often. And it was, I guess it's that sort of epic. It's about family and relationships. There's so much going on, but she really juggles it all quite well and keeps you interested in the story, and I did want to keep coming back to it. It was just gorgeously told on both a sentence level and then just overall. So that is There Are Rivers in the Sky by Elif Shafak. And just like you, I feel like going to her backlist, Island of Missing Trees was her previous novel, which got rave reviews as well, and I somehow missed out on it.
Well, I think I said this either last month or the month before, but this reminds me of People of the Book by Geraldine Brooks.
How everything, I need to, yes.
Why don't I read this? I'll read There Are Rivers in the Sky. You read People of the Book, okay. And we'll talk about it for our November episode.
Okay.
Can we
I'll do that? Absolutely. Okay. We'll do that. I have a copy of People of the Book, and I will lend you my copy of Rivers.
Thank you.
Awesome.
All right. Okay, so my next book is called Scaffolding by Lauren Elkin.
Oh, you loved this one.
I did.
This one was the one you sort of told me about as you were reading.
Yeah, it's a fantastic novel set in Paris. It follows two separate couples who live in the exact same apartment in Paris, but decades apart. You know, one is modern day, but then the other one is in the 1970s. And both of the wives who live in this apartment are psychoanalysts, and they both are involved with their, you know, respective feminist movements. Elkin does a really nice job just with keeping the reader guessing about some of the characters. And I just kind of love that even when I interviewed her, I had to say, now this was this and this, right? Did I get that right? And she just smiled and said yes. But I loved that I wasn't quite sure. It was really great delivery with that. You know, the novel explores love and desire and fidelity and loss and in a lot of psychoanalysis theory, but she does it in such an accessible way. She told me that she didn't really want the reader to feel like they had to know anything about this, but they could still kind of understand it. And it wasn't presented in a way that was way above somebody or way well below either. It was just a really nice balance. And here's another thing is I read a preview copy of this on my iPad, which I typically do not like. I mean, my eyes just don't like looking at bright screens anymore. But with this one, Elkin would pepper in French words and phrases. And all I had to do was highlight the text and hit the, like, translate button.
I know.
And it would just pop up. And it was really nice.
So handy, which is, you know, I prefer a hardback written book or paperback written book to my Kindle. But boy, that is a really handy tool to be able to hit a word and get a definition or a translation.
Yeah. She, like one of her main characters, her dad is American and her mother is French. So she's a Franco-American and she thinks in two languages. And she's now a translator, but she wasn't when she wrote this book. And she said that she actually wrote an exact, like a mirror image of this book, except it's written in French. And then the French phrases that are in the English version are written in English.
Oh my gosh.
I know. She's like, well, what else am I going to do with my time?
But yeah, right.
Yeah, I really enjoyed this one. And you know, what's funny is I receive probably at least a dozen requests for author interviews every single day. And with scaffolding, I actually looked for a book that was published on this specific day because I needed a book, and I found it in Edelweiss. I figured out who the publicist was. I reached out to the publicist, and they said yes. And it turned out to be a really great thing because it was actually one I went after instead of it being presented to me.
I love that. That sort of bookish serendipity. Sometimes those are books that just are meant to be for you. You know, it's like you needed something that was published on this day. So you looked, and whether it was the cover that spoke to you or the description or whatever, I love when that happens. I do have a question about the title. When I think of the word scaffolding, being an education reporter in my day-to-day life, that term is used in education to mean having a base of knowledge that you then put more on top of, you know, like you're scaffolding your lessons. Is this kind of had many meanings? Yeah, I could see that.
It had many meanings, and the least of which was, you know, in Paris, every 20 years or so, they have to reface all of their buildings.
So there's literal scaffolding everywhere.
There's literal scaffolding everywhere. But yeah, it did have layered meanings.
Very cool. Very cool.
So yeah, that was Scaffolding by Lauren Elkin.
Okay, I think I'm putting that on my list too. There's too many books on my list, Beth.
I'd loan it to you, but I read it on my iPad.
That's the other bad part of e-books. You can't share them easily.
And I can't go back to it. I have to buy it.
Yeah.
Which is, I mean, I'm fine buying
it. Sure.
But it's one I want to have on my shelf, and I will actually go buy the hardcover.
Yeah. That's happened to me a lot this year. Okay, so my next book is kind of an odd one. It's a backlist book, very, very back, because I've been working on finishing up my 2024 Read ICT Challenge, which is a 12-month challenge we've been doing, this partnership with the Wichita Library and the Wichita Eagle, and we put out this challenge every year. One of the categories this year is a book published the year you turn 16.
Huh.
So my year, I turned 16, I'm just going to tell everyone how old I am, was 1984. So I was looking, as you just talked about with scaffolding, I was just looking for a book published in 1984. And turns out that Roald Dahl's childhood memoir, I won't even call it Roald Dahl's memoir because it is just a look back at his childhood. The title is Boy.
Memoir doesn't have to encompass an entire life. It's usually just one segment.
Okay,
of life.
I think he actually has sort of different books.
Oh, okay, gotcha.
That, you know, sort of a multi-volume memoir, so to speak. But anyway, so this is called Boy by Roald Dahl, and it talks about his life from birth till about 16 or 17. And what a delightful! I mean, I love and appreciate Roald Dahl's books from the time I was a child. I had just recently seen Matilda on the stage in Wichita, and actually talked to some kids who were in that production, so that was fresh in my mind. Love, you know, Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, and so James and the Giant Peach, and so many of his books are so much a part of my childhood. I've always loved his kind of attitude and irreverence, and most of all, I've loved the way he really sticks it to adults in his novels, because so often kids are, you know, the victims of a lot of things. This memoir really showed where he got his inspiration. I mean, from real life, he talks about when he was 6 or 7 years old and the highlight of his town was this candy shop. And
aww,
he remembers he and his friends just staring through the window and then going in and having a certain amount of money that they could spend. So all that he remembers, all the different candy flavors, and one of them was a Gobstopper. So I'm like writing these notes in the novel, just like, oh my gosh, of course, it's Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. He talks about horrible headmasters of his boarding school, and you know exactly where Mrs. Trunchbull comes from, you know? It just gives you the backstory and shows how much a person's life can affect their work. And I just thought it was fantastic. And it was a very quick read. It's actually a middle grade book. Hmm. It's intended, there's illustrations in it, really fun illustrations. And it's intended for young audiences. And of course, I love to read middle grade anyway, but it was a real fun pick. So that was Boy by Roald Dahl.
That just shows what the challenge can do for you in that you've find books that you weren't planning on reading, you weren't expecting to read it, you needed something to fill a need and it ended up surprising you.
Yes, very much so. Very much. We only hope that we can continue that with the 25 challenge, which is in the works.
That's right.
What's your next read?
Okay, my next one is Bone of the Bone by Sarah Smarsh.
Yes.
Sarah Smarsh has been writing about political and socioeconomic issues through the lens of her rural upbringing for over a decade. And this book, Bone of the Bone, is a collection of some of her previously published essays, which showcase her skills in both journalism and creative writing. You know, they're presented in the order that they appeared in publications like the New York Times, The Guardian, The Atlantic, Harper's. And I also listened to the book as I read the physical copy, because you know I like to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And Sarah Smarsh is the narrator of that book. I found this kind of interesting because these essays were written for print. Yet, because she had a double major in journalism and creative writing from KU, these essays also translated beautifully into audio. Okay, so Sarah Smarsh grew up just a few miles from where I was born and grew up.
Very famously a Kansan.
Yes, she is. And she offers a unique perspective through her essays, especially to the publications in which they appear. She tries to represent the people in the Midwest who are often stereotyped and misrepresented by media outlets on the coast. She tries to be the voice for those in flyover country.
Which she did in Heartland, her previous book.
Yes.
Yeah.
But this is a collection of essays that she's been writing since, I think the first one was 2013.
Mm.
And so it was interesting to read how some of them aged. I mean, it's been 11 years since that very first essay.
Yeah, some things. And she talks and she writes a lot about politics. So I'm sure a lot of those were like, oh, that was a different lifetime ago.
But a lot of them
still timely.
Yes.
Wow.
Yeah.
Very cool.
It was an interesting read.
I find her so smart and she has this incredible way of picking out as you mentioned in your interview with her, the piece she did after Tim Walz was selected as Kamala Harris's running mate, just how significant that was culturally. And I just think I love getting her perspective, because as you say, especially in the coastal media, that we don't often hear from the Midwest at all, but certainly not from, you know, rural Kansas.
Right.
And I thought that piece was well done. I thought your interview was fantastic.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I appreciate that.
How fun.
So that was Bone of the Bone by Sarah Smarsh.
Very cool. Okay. I wanted to say real quick before I get to my last book that I also read Search by Michelle Hunnevin this month.
Yeah.
I'm not going to go too much into it because we have that in a previous episode, and I'll figure out which episode that is and put it in the show notes of this one just in case someone wants to go back and hear your description of it, Beth, because you were the one who encouraged me to read it. You had read it more than a year ago, I think.
I think so.
But I picked it up. I don't even know why. I know why. It was the challenge as well. It was the challenge. Oh, my gosh. Yeah, I needed a book with recipes. And Search by Michelle Hunnevin tells the story of a search for a new pastor at this Universalist church. And so the narrator sort of talks about, as she's serving on this committee, she's also writing a cookbook. Oh, my gosh. I just had to say that I love this book so much because of its look at group dynamics and just how different people come at a task. And there was so much going on in that book. I felt like the main character was someone I could be friends with.
Mm-hmm.
And I just wanted to go to one of her review lunches with her and just chat. And then also just the ending really shook me and threw me for a loop. It wasn't what I was expecting at all. I just highly recommend it. It's Search by Michelle Hunnevin.
You know, I never share when we would do interviews through Zoom. I record them, but we never share the video.
Mm-hmm.
But I think I still have, I'll have to find that video and show it to you, because after our interview, she showed me her kitchen.
Oh my gosh, I would love that.
Yeah, I'll have to do that.
Yeah, I do. So my next book is Graveyard Shift by M.L. Rio. So fans of M.L. Rio are fans because of her debut novel, which came out in 2017, called If We Were Villains. Beth, this is a novel that I loved so much at the time. It has stuck with me, and it is one I continually recommend to people, especially in the fall. It's got this academic setting. It's a little bit creepy. It's students at a Shakespeare conservatory, and there's a murder, and they try and it's kind of got mystery and dark academia vibes to it. Well, I saw that M.L. Rio had a new book out. It's actually a novella. And I was so excited. I hit yes, yes, I want to check that out. I was thrilled to hear about it. I've been waiting since, well, not long after 2017 for her next work. And as I said on KMUW, this is almost everything you'd expect from Rio. It was just too short.
Aww.
I mean, it's a novella. So, novellas have their own, pros and cons. But let me tell you about it. So Graveyard Shift sort of tells the story of five friends, and they all work the late shift in a college town. So in that way, it's very much like her first novel. They all work the late shift for various reasons. One is the editor of the student paper. There's a bartender. There's a hotel receptionist that works the overnight hours. There's an Uber driver. And there's a caretaker of a local, sort of church property. They meet for a smoke break at the church cemetery, because this is an October novel and they need to meet for a smoke break at a cemetery. And they suddenly see a stranger dump something into this hole. It's not obviously a grave, but there's a hole dug in this kind of forgotten area of the cemetery. They see a stranger approach, dump something into the hole, and then they set out to investigate. So this novella is so well told. Again, all the great creepy vibes of M.L. Rio's initial novel. It's just in a short form. So when you get to the end, I actually talked to someone about this who had also recently read it. It's got one of those endings where it's like, wait, what? Oh, no. I mean, is it, that's it I want? These characters were all so interesting. You just keep thinking this could be a novel. There's so much there, but it just seems, so compressed. It's obviously through no fault of M.L. Rio's. This is a wonderful work. It's just that I want more, 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 more. Right. And I'm very demanding. And I'm hoping, against hope, that she is working on another novel. But that is Graveyard Shift by M.L. Rio, a great, creepy little taste of suspense and gothic sort of writing for this time of year.
Very good.
Yeah.
Okay, my last one is Hamlet.
Oh,
by
what?
William Shakespeare.
Speaking of graveyards.
And I'm counting this because I read the first quarto, which is also called the bad quarto, and the folio, and the second quarto. So I read Hamlet three times.
Wow.
Three different Hamlets. So the first quarto, I should spell that because Suzanne didn't know what I was saying. Q-U-A-R-T-O, quarto.
Thank you.
It's the early version of the play based on a playbook. And these are all hypotheses.
I'm wondering, these are people's theories about what it was, right?
So early version of the play based on a playbook used for performance at the Globe around the year 1600 and possibly composed through the 1590s. The second quarto is a revision made around 1602, and the text was printed from the author's papers and revised from the manuscript, and it was the underlying copy for the source for the first quarto, and it was likely used for an indoor performance and possibly publication.
Hmm.
Like they would have made them different lengths, like if it were to be, performed in front of the Queen or something.
Oh, very cool.
Yeah, and then the folio version, and the folio is a collection of Shakespeare's work. First folio is when a bunch of his work was collected and printed as a book. That was the folio.
Okay.
And it was another revision, and it was the text printed from a theatrical manuscript that predates the final form of copy for the second quarto, but may include some later playhouse changes. So these were, they were revised as they were performed. And so I read three different Hamlets. One was the first quarto, the bad quarto, said, "To be or not to be." Huh. That's the point. Or something like that.
What?
And the second one was, "To be or not to be." That is the question. Yeah. So it was fascinating to see the evolution of Shakespeare's Hamlet through all of these revisions.
How very cool. Yeah. And can I just say, I can totally tell you're in grad school right now. How neat. So it makes me wonder what version most students read.
The second quarto.
Really?
Yes.
Why the second and not the final?
Well, there's still a third one and a fourth one.
Oh, my gosh.
Right.
And, you know, we were talking recently about The History of Sound by Ben Shattuck. Uh-huh. Wonderful collection of short stories. I'm going to plug it again. But the evolution of short stories through publication, too. We were just talking about mm-hmm. this. Like, one of his stories that was in, you know, could be in The New Yorker. And then by the time it's in his collection, that's the published book collection, it could be different. That is so cool to think
about. Yeah, and I actually visited with Bill Rohrbach about this years ago, and I asked him about, okay, why was this way in The New Yorker and this way here? And he's like, oh, it was a completely different thing that we performed for this radio blah, blah, blah. I don't remember now uh-huh. exactly, but these short stories evolve a lot.
That is very cool. Were you aware that Jody, I'm going to say Picou or Picoult. I don't know how you pronounce her last name. It's P-I-C-O-U-L-T. And her latest novel is called By Any Other Name, and it's about the woman who many scholars think wrote a lot of the Shakespeare plays. Do you know that?
No.
Yeah. I mean, I don't normally read her stuff, but I picked up a copy of this book because I'm fascinated. I heard an interview that she had with somebody about this is like her, you know, a book written from her heart because she's been interested in this topic for decades and now she's finally writing about it. But yeah, all the theories around Shakespeare and what he wrote
you
and when
the
and
look
who,
on my face, right?
Yes, I know. You're like it's conspiracy theorists.
Yes.
But you never know. There's a lot of evidence. Okay, so those were our current reads,
right.
And we are wishing everyone out there a wonderful reading October. But now we're going to transition into our next segment where we really get into some titles that are upcoming and books to get excited about with Kelly Justice. So hello, Kelly.
Hey, Kelly. I'm so glad you joined us today.
I am so delighted you invited me. Thank you.
Can you talk to us about Fountain Bookstore? Tell us about the store.
Oh, you know, Fountain Bookstore has been in business since 1978. We're in the heart of downtown Richmond. It's a historic district with cobblestones, very pretty. And we're a tiny store with a really big mouth. people come in and they're like, you know, we thought you'd be bigger, which I never really know how to take. We're a small bookstore. We work with authors all the time. Author events is our focus. We work with over 150 authors a year. And that's us in a nutshell.
So what books are you excited about? We finally have reached October, but we're curious about anything you're excited about for the month or anything you've been excited about lately.
Well, you know, there's a book that I just think is not getting enough attention. It came out in August. So I want to talk about that first because I'm obsessed with it. And it is called Man Boobs, a memoir of musicals, visas, hope, and cake. And it's by Kamal
Ajazuddin.
That's our best guess. We will have it spelled out on the website in the show notes.
I love everything about this book. I laughed. I cried. It's got everything. It's a memoir by an author who he is gay. He is Pakistani. He is also dealing with body dysmorphia issues, and he's overweight most of his life. And it is one of the most incredible looks at the, you know, intersectionality of all these different identities and how they look depending on where in the world he's living, you know, because his home is Pakistan and he lives in Canada and he lives in England and lives in the United States, and his different identities determine how he is able to live and what he's able to accomplish in each place. And it is devastatingly funny. You know, if you can imagine maybe David Sedaris with like a whole lot more sex, you know, in the content. And it's got a great cover. I know we're on radio, but you have to see the cover because it's just awesome. And he's also a well-respected artist and currently living in the US. So all of these things, I can't say enough about it. It's just the best. It's going to be in my top five for sure this year.
Oh my God. I'm so excited about that title. I have not heard of that book. I love a book. This is why booksellers are the best.
You know, a lot of people don't realize this, but this is a title from Abrams Books. And most people, when you think of Abrams, you're thinking of gift books and art books, but they have got this pocket of really spectacular memoir that they're doing right now. And I apologize, I do not know the editor who is in charge of acquiring these little gems, but it is, they're really, really a publisher to watch in this category.
Fantastic. Thanks so much for that best kept secret. Hopefully it won't be after this airs. What's your next title?
So I like to read history, but I have a really short attention span and I can't get through a lot of the dry, dusty tomes with, I just have a really hard time, but I do demand that my history books be scrupulously researched and accurate. So Eden Undone is written by Abbott Kaler, who is a journalist by trade, but I think writes some of the best history on the market. History has to be written in a way that it moves like fiction to me. And there's nothing better than history that is stranger than fiction. And Abbott Kaler has a way of finding these stories. I don't know how she does it, but she's found another one. And it features a Berlin doctor's in the World War II. And he decides to, he had it with the world and he's going to live separated from it on Galapagos Islands. And he takes with him his lover, who is also his patient, which is kind of icky. And there's also this weird wife swap where like he left his wife and took his lover and then left his wife with the lover's husband. So they kind of switched. I don't know, it seemed to work for them. But you can't make these things up. He also, as a doctor, recognized that people get sick really easily when they don't have access to regular medical care. So prophylactically, he pulled all of his teeth out and replaced them with steel dentures, which I don't even really have to say anything else about that. It's just terrifying. So he's there and he's happy with his lover. And then, of course, a family reads about this in the paper and they're like, hey, we think that's a great idea too. We're going to leave society as well. And they decide to move to the same island where this steel denture guy is. And he didn't want any friends. That's why he went there in the first place. So already we've got tension. And then, as if that wasn't enough, somebody else reads about it. And it's a baroness. And she actually was a baroness. She brings her two male sex servants and quite literal whipping boys. And she wants to put a big resort on this Galapagos Island. Well, things happen, people go missing, and there's some murder stuff. You really just can't make these stories up. It is riveting. I could not put it down. It's also very funny. I'm sure that the people who are the subjects of this book did not intend it to be funny, but it is. And they had to rush this book to publication. This is a little bit behind the scenes. Crown had to rush this book to publication because Ron Howard has a movie actually coming out on this exact same group of people. And they could not let the book come out after the movie because the last 7 years of the author's life would have been like, oh, I guess you just copied Ron Howard. It's just this parallel development thing. It just almost never happens, especially with stories this unknown and bizarre. But read the book first and then go see Ron Howard's movie. I think it would be an awesome way to spend your October.
You had me at he pulled all his teeth out.
He did.
That is an incredible sounding title.
You don't have to put this in, but after a while, her teeth all fell out, and then they shared the dentures so they could eat.
It just gets weirder and weirder.
And the dentures never fit because he's had them fitted when his gums are still swollen, so they would just fall out all the time. And I'm promising you, the pretty Hollywood actor they've got playing this guy is probably not going to have these issues. I can't imagine that this is going to be part of this movie because it's not going to look. Who is it? Is Ralph Fiennes, I think, is playing him?
Oh, man, Voldemort.
Yeah, they're not going to have him have big, scary metal teeth that are falling out all the time, I'm pretty sure. But maybe,
Oh, my gosh, I'm so intrigued by that title.
Yeah, it's so cool. I love the cover, too. It's a challenging book to put a cover on, I think. And I think they nailed it. And something specifically for October, The Nightmare Before Christmas. Have you heard of this one?
I have not. It sounds like maybe a
Oh
romance.
My gosh. I love romance. I really love a holiday romance. I love Halloween. I also love Christmas. And they've put them together in a big queer love story. And there is nothing that makes me happier than something like this. It is bliss. So Princess Nicholas Claus, well, he used to love Christmas, but since his dad turned it into like this soulless predatory like corporation, he's like jaded, doesn't want to take over the family business. And because of his role in the family business, he's being set up to marry the Princess of Easter, who's also his best friend. And by the way, everybody in this book is bisexual. And this is the other thing I love about this book. Normally, when you have bisexual characters in a romance book, they're sleeping with every single person on the planet, because that is the stereotype of the bisexual person in queer romance. And I'm tired of looking at that. So these people are just all happen to be bisexual and looking for love, as everyone is, you know? So he's upset about this arranged marriage, and he is drowning his sorrows at a local bar up in Santa Land. And he has this really super sexy brief encounter with a mysterious guy that he meets behind the bar. And later on, he finds out that this guy, this man, is the ultra hot Prince Hex of Halloween. So I don't know how this author is going to top this book, but I think it's just got something extra special, pumpkin spice, candy cane, you know, everything going for it.
Talk about perfect for this time of year.
Oh, isn't it? Isn't it? And it'll go all the way through Christmas. It's just yummy. The author is Sarah Rosh, and I have never read her before, but I will be reading her again. So I cannot. Oh, it's got the pretty sprayed edges that we all love so much. Well, you know, let's talk about another book that has sprayed edges that is not in the romance or romanticy category. 8 Very Bad Nights. Todd Goldberg is the editor. This is a collection of Hanukkah noir, and Soho Crime is the publisher. I think they're innovative. They just started a new horror imprint called Hell's Hundred, but this is not horror. This is very much noir. It's got this very cool cover with a dreidel with like a skull and a knife on it, and then these light blue stained edges that are reminiscent of the Hanukkah colors. Some of the stories are really twisted. Some of them are really heartwarming. All of the authors are not Jewish. It's just that stories center around Hanukkah. Some of the stories are funny. They have Lee Goldberg's in there, Gabino Iglesias, Jim Ruland, David L. Ulin, and so many great authors. And I found the stories funny. I think it's going to make a great gift. Oh, and I forgot my favorite part about this book. At the very bottom of the book, well, we're on radio, so I couldn't show it to you anyway. But at the very bottom of the book, there's a little dreidel. And if you flip the pages, it spins.
Oh, my God.
So
that's cute. Cool.
It's like a little baby flip book at the bottom. And I was reading, and I was like, what is this on every page? And then I got it. And that was just a little extra special thing that they put in there for us at Soho. Little Lost Library. I don't know if you know about this. This is number 7. I don't normally talk about, you know, late in series books, but this is number 7 in the Secret Book and Scone Society by Ellery Adams. And this series is an exception to 2 of my very strictest reading rules, which is 1, I don't read past number 3 because the author will be fine and no longer needs me. So, you know, we can move on because they're safe. And number 2, I do not read books with a bookstore owner as the main character. It's like cops don't watch cop shows. Doctors don't read books about doctors. You know, I don't read bookseller books. But it's Ellery Adams, and she is one of my absolute favorite mystery authors. Technically, I guess she falls under the cozy and is published by Kensington, but her cozies have a kind of hard edge to them, and I like that about them. There's a great deal of depth and character development. They're set in Miracle Springs, North Carolina, which is a fictional small town, and Nora, who's the owner of the bookstore, she has three other friends, 2 other business owners, and another woman who runs a local business. and they solve murders together, and that would be interesting enough. But it's these deep connections between these women, the secrets they share and the support that they give to each other that bring me back to this series again and again. It is a flawless group of books and they never fail to satisfy. I mean, I just absolutely adore them. So well written. The Bishop's Villa is from a publisher that's very dear to me, Europa Editions, who got the best book of the century so far with my brilliant friend and a remarkably consistent publisher. And this is also translated from the Italian. And this is a story of World War II. And you think I've read all the World War II stories, but you haven't. There are always more stories to tell and more perspectives to show. So this is a novel based on actual events that happened in a tiny village named La Caz. This is a story of how everyday people, you know, individuals, not great leaders, not the soldiers, but everyday citizens made a difference in the course of the war. It's based on true events about the collaboration between the Catholic Diocese of Grosseto and the fascist authorities. They are working together, and it's really quite horrifying. I've never read historical fiction like this in my life. I don't think it's tense and inspiring. It's just a very small masterpiece. It's a tiny, quick read, and I think it's a must read. The Bishop's Villa, and it's by Sasha Naspini.
Well, Kelly, thank you so much. I really loved this conversation that we had with you today, and I loved hearing about all of these books, and my stack just seems to be growing, growing by leaps and bounds.
That's the job.
So. Well, and if you are listening to this and if you are near Richmond, Virginia, stop in to see Kelly Justice at Fountain Bookstore. And yeah, it's you're going to have a real treat.
Come see us.
Thanks again, Kelly. That sounds like a great place to stop. So until next time,
keep turning those pages.
Bye, Beth.
Bye, Suzanne.
Books and Whatnot is a production of KMUW Wichita. Our team of engineers, producers, editors, and hosts are Mark Statzer, Torin Anderson, Haley Krausen, Jonathan Huber, Luann Stevens, Carly Cooper, Beth Golay, and Suzanne Perez. You can reach us by email sent to podcasts@kmuw.org, on Twitter @BooksAndWhatnot, and on Instagram, books_and_whatnot. Find more conversations and a list of books discussed in this episode at kmuw.org.
The candidates for November are set.
I know Donald Trump's tight.
Between now and Election Day.
We are not going back.
A campaign season unfolding faster.
Kamala Harris is not getting a promotion.
Than any in recent history.
Make America great again.
Follow it all with new episodes every weekday on the NPR Politics Podcast.